The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
There was a miraculous story recently that you might have seen about a Sherpa guide who went missing for a week but then managed to make his way back to the Mount Everest base camp. He'd been missing so long that his family had begun the funeral rituals for him. Well, I'm joined now on the line by the last person to see Dawa Sherpa before he went missing, climber and YouTuber Chris Thrall, and in the studio by climber and founder of Earth's Edge, James McManus. Chris, I'll come to you first. Good morning to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Claire. How are you doing?
Good. To explain to us what happened here.
Quite simple, really. We were coming down from the summit. We had two Sherpas who we kind of used interchangeably. No disrespect meant to them, but we had two Sherpas attached to two climbers. On this particular event, we were coming down from the infamous Camp 4. One of the Sherpas sat on his backpack for a rest. I was the nearest to him. I turned around and said, "Are you okay, brother?" He said, "Yep, fine, Chris. You carry on." Unbeknown to us, he was struggling with oxygen. He didn't mention this. It's completely normal to sit down on your backpack and take a rest. We'd done it hundreds of times, Claire. You know, one of us would go first, then sit down for a break. The other one would overtake. So, nothing was sort of untoward. But when I came down over a feature called the Yellow Band, which is quite fair, not a particularly steep abseil, but some people choose to abseil over it, I came across my fellow climber, a Polish chap who appeared to be struggling. When I asked him if he was okay, he said, "I've run out of oxygen." And I knew from the day before, from his attempted summit, that he had fairly severe frostbite in his fingers. So at that point, obviously, all my attention turned to getting him down the mountain safely, which was supposed to be a two-hour, would have been a two-hour trek to Camp 3, where I figured we might be able to find a tent and find a cooker to heat up some water and this guy could get some sleep. We were actually on our way to Camp 2. This is the way the rotations are done. And as we descended, I looked back up and it was apparent that the other Sherpa wasn't joining us for whatever reason, and his head torch wasn't on. So
and what options did you feel, Chris, that you had at that point, given the conditions? I mean, was there anything you can do, or do you just have to keep going?
Well, I'm going above and beyond, Claire, to help the Polish climber.
Yeah.
This isn't really how it works. You're not supposed to find yourself alone with another climber in pretty much the death zone, then with no oxygen and frostbite. That's kind of a big ask to get them down the mountain. And that was that. The as far as we were concerned, the other Sherpa, he was, you know, he was doing his thing, so to speak, and he's gonna any minute, you know, come bounding down the mountain and join us.
But that's not what happened, and he went missing then for so long that, as I said, his family thought that they would never see him again.
Yes, I'd met his family the day before he reappeared, and we'd had a very emotional meeting. They were incredibly nice to me. They made it clear, look, we know you're just a client. You shouldn't really be involved in this. I offered to help them financially with his daughter's education because, you know, this is crunch time, Claire. This is something serious has happened. And lo and behold, we get the news starts to trickle in the next day that that he's been found.
And what have you learned about what had happened to him and how did he get back?
Well, subsequently, in the most recent reports, it turned out he'd run out of oxygen. There's a whole load more to that scenario than it probably sounds. There was oxygen on the mountain, and he didn't have the, you know, like I say, for some reason, he didn't communicate that to me. I don't know if he felt he was, you know, obliged to kind of take control of his situation and not be saying to a client, hey, look, I've got no, I have no, I can only sort of speculate. But yeah, in the meantime, I'm coming down the mountain in what was extremely changeable weather. A lot of time it was white out. A lot of time the ropes were covered with snow. So we were having to guess, not sort of, you know, make an educated guess which way down. I mean, it's a huge mountain. 1 foot wrong and you could end up in a crevasse.
Of course. And have you been able to speak to him since he came back, or to his wife or his daughter?
No, I've requested a chat via, you know, WhatsApp or something, but he was in the ICU when I asked. So they were saying, you know, obviously the doctors were recommending that he doesn't speak to anyone whilst he was in there.
But I understand from reports that he is doing well and he's expected to make a full recovery, isn't he?
Yes, from everything that we see, it's you know, it's a, how can you say, I'll say good result all round, but it's certainly an awful lot better than it could have been, Claire.
Gosh, I mean, you yourself, you know, being so involved in this, it must have been quite a, you said you had an emotional conversation with his family, but the whole thing must have taken quite a toll on you, did it?
You know, you don't, when you're in the death zone, you don't really have any chance, Claire, to be getting emotional. You've got to focus on, you know, in this case, getting the, helping the other climber down. It's the high mountains. It's incredibly serious. If it wasn't hard, then obviously thousands more people would attempt it every year, and you've got to kind of take these things on the chin. And yeah. I'm not trying to sound cold or callous, but you know, this is, like I say, if it was easy, everybody
yeah,
would
but,
do it.
You know, it's the reality of what you do, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us to tell us about it. Chris Thrall there, who is a climber and a YouTuber. As I said, founder of Earth's Edge, James McManus, is with us. James, you're very welcome. I mean, that story is a reminder of how dangerous it is, this stuff that you do, and you choose to do it in an even more dangerous way. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I'm trying to climb these mountains without supplementary oxygen, which is another level of suffering and challenge, I guess.
But, why would you do that?
Oh, look, like any athlete, I want to test myself. And in my sport, like trying to climb Mount Everest without supplementary oxygen is the ultimate. It's the ultimate test of human endurance, and I'm very much drawn to that.
But you've broken a record in that regard recently?
Yeah, I just climbed the first Irish ascent of Lhotse without supplementary oxygen, which is the fourth highest mountain in the world. So that's 8,516 metres, which is a new Irish record, yeah.
How, like, what is the preparation you can do for doing something like that?
Yeah, basically at a high altitude, because there's so little oxygen, you can only work at a low intensity. So your training needs to be very long and slow, so your heart and lungs improve and become more efficient. So it's very similar to the kind of training someone would do for Ironman or ultramarathon. It's all generally long and slow.
Okay, yeah. So just going back to what we heard from Chris there, I mean, that story which made international headlines and is incredible, and you know, thankfully that man is back and safe and well now. But I suppose it has brought into the public consciousness the role of Sherpas and what they do. Will you tell us a little bit about the important part they play in those Everest climbs?
Yeah, I think, like, as you said, it's an absolutely epic story, like an amazing rescue, amazing outcome. So the Sherpa, like, just to give you a little bit of background on them, they're an ethnic group in Nepal. They make up 1% of the population. But also the workers who work on Everest are referred to as Sherpa. It's a little bit confusing. So you have other ethnic groups working in that population. So what makes them unique is, like, their genetic makeup. Like, they are incredibly strong. They've been living at altitude for thousands and thousands of years. And they spend their childhood, like, moving, going to school in a high altitude like environment where they go up and down hills all the time. So they're adapted to it. And their role on the mountain which is very relevant to this story, is to support clients in getting to the top. It's not possible for 99% of Western climbers to go to the top of Everest without the support of a Sherpa.
They're Why? There to carry for the guidance or what exactly is their role?
For a multitude, okay, the first part is you have a Sherpa fixing team. They fix a rope to the top that everybody connects into so they don't fall off the mountain. So they're needed. They're just so strong, like their weight to power ratio. And then to carry loads, to carry people's gear and to carry oxygen higher up on the mountain for people, they're really the ones that can do that.
Like, so they go ahead of you, do they?
They go ahead. So let's say, so Chris, for example, before his summit push, he would have taken 2 weeks rest in base camp. And before that, he was on the mountain doing a rotation, acclimatizing. And in that 2 week period while he's resting, his Sherpa, Hilary Dawa Sherpa, he's carrying oxygen higher up. So Chris and all these climbers can have oxygen as they go higher up, carrying tents, oxygen, food, all that kind of thing.
Are they treated well?
Yeah, it's you know, you have to understand that Nepal is one of the poorest countries in the world with no employment law. So in most cases, they're treated really, really well. And it's a very positive thing for people to go trekking and climbing in Nepal, but it's important to understand there's no employment law. So you need to check with the operator, how much are you paying your staff? Do they get fair, like, you know, they've been treated properly? Are they insured? Is there something set up that if they do, unfortunately, you know, if they get into trouble, where in Hilary Dawa's case, where he may not be able to work next season because of injuries, that there's insurance there to support his family.
So check all of that. You're saying.
Yeah, check all of that for sure.
And is there a custom where the climber will tip the Sherpa, particularly if they make a successful climb to the summit?
Yeah, so all climbers should give what we call a summit bonus. So you give a bonus over and above what you pay your operator.
But is that by choice rather than in any sort of a contract?
It's like, you know, in Ireland when you tip in a restaurant, it's by choice. But in America, it's like, you know, everyone tips. So everybody gives a summit bonus for mm-hmm. sure. But it's not like written down in law that you have to do it, but okay. It's a given.
Just when it comes to Mount Everest, it was a very rare thing like a couple of decades ago for people to climb Mount Everest. Yeah. Less so now.
Yeah.
Are there people doing it who maybe shouldn't be?
Well, the thing is that where Everest gets dangerous, and when you use this specific example, like without knowing the details, what those guys were still doing on the mountain at 5 p.m. and how they kept going when they knew, obviously should have known they're running out of oxygen is kind of crazy. So where you have inexperienced climbers going with budget operators, there it becomes dangerous. Where you have someone who doesn't have that much experience, but they're paying a reputable operator who has a qualified guide and they have lots of oxygen, lots of safety there, it's fine for people with less experience to go on the mountain.
But can I decide I'm going to climb Mount Everest?
You can
tomorrow.
Decide. Not tomorrow. We'd have to wait till next season. But yeah, I'll take you. No problem.
Yeah, but see, I have no experience of mountain climbing.
Yeah. So okay, next year is a bit of an exaggeration. So what we would do is like get you on something like Kilimanjaro, get you climbing like the highest mountain in South America, Aconcagua, gain some experience, teach you the relevant skills. Make sure you're going with a qualified, experienced Sherpa.
Yeah, but you
then
see,
it's possible.
But my point is that I can go and do it without having done any of these things.
Absolutely,
and I can end up in big trouble potentially.
Yeah, and that's something that as an industry on Everest specifically, we are trying collectively to change the rules that people have to have prior experience. The Sherpa has to be qualified. We need medical checks in base camp and in camp two before people go up. So at the moment, you're absolutely right. It is poorly regulated in regard to the standard of operations, safety standards, and also the prerequisites of the climbers coming on the mountain. That does need to change.
How is the environment of Mount Everest surviving all of this interest in it?
Like the actual, like you're talking about the environment. Yeah. So there is massive amount of snowmelt there. Huge, like the ice fall is becoming smaller and smaller, like there's less ice, is more rock exposed. There is legacy rubbish on Everest, but all the rubbish from this season, most if not all of that, is coming down.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, you have to think you're in a country where there's no refuse collection at all. So actually Everest and the valley people trek up is one of the cleanest in the Himalaya, and that's due to education and tourism, basically.
And how does a fellow from Ross Grey end up in this business?
It's a good question, yeah. So, look, it's just been a passion of mine from a young age to go try climb these mountains and bring people there as well. I have groups going to the Himalaya with me in October. I'm living my dream to go to go and do there.
Was it a family thing? Were you brought up with this sort of interest?
Yeah, my mum got me into this and into kayaking and into adventure at a young age. Yeah, so always kind of in a caravan, cruising around the country, climbing mountains.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it's great.
And is there a growing interest in it from your business point of view?
Yeah, massive. Like, obviously not people going directly to Everest, but we have people who are interested in learning how to hike. Like in Ireland, we do introduction to hiking courses and then take them on a journey, let's say from 4-day trips up to a week, 10 days, 3 weeks, and even up to something like Everest, which is a 55-day expedition. But people are looking for experiences now, you know, they want to get outside.
Do they get hooked on it then pretty
exactly,
quickly?
Yeah.
You see it happening, do you?
Absolutely, yeah. Some of the shorter trips, they get hooked on that. Like we have a 4-day trip to the highest mountain in North Africa, in Morocco. People get a taste for it and they keep pushing it. Generally, people get to a point where they don't want to suffer anymore. Like, and you know, going back to the story of Chris there, I know he got some online abuse for people saying, why didn't he wait for Hilary Dawa? But you have to understand, I couldn't even put into words how tired that man was, like Chris. And his gut instinct was to try and help the guy in front of him with frostbite rather than go back for his guide. His presumption would have been his guide would have been fit and well. So yeah. It's incredibly tough.
Is like, there a rule about that, about never going back? Like even if it's an unwritten rule?
To go back up the mountain for somebody?
If you're on a descent.
No, like generally you would stick together. But because that's a 5 or 6 day ascent and they become so tired and actually the terrain is relatively easy, people do naturally split up. So coming off Lhotse this spring, that's 8,500 meters. Despite us both being very tired, my Sherpa and I were on a 30-day summit push. At 8,200 meters, we split up. He went ahead of me and I came down a little bit slower than him.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's your next mountain then? Your next big personal challenge?
Big personal challenge is in spring 2027. I'm tempting to be the first Irish person to climb Mount Everest without supplementary oxygen.
So Mount Everest is the next one with no oxygen.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay, well, listen, we'll talk to you about that.
Loved it, yeah.
Good to meet you, James. Thanks so much. James McManus and his company is called Earth's Edge. James, thank you very much.
The Clare Byrne Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.